want all of you to know first that I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to talk to such a beautiful group of people. And I'll tell you right now that I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I haven't any idea. But it has been suggested that I talk about this matter of finding peace within oneself, which can be done. But before I get into that, I'd like to tell you a story about an intellectual expert on elm trees. He was quite an expert on elm trees. He studied elm trees from the time he was a young man until he was a very old gentleman. And he studied at all of the universities and all of the colleges all over the world about elm trees. He read all the books that had ever been written on elm trees. He became known the world over as the leading authority on elm trees. He could tell you the exact chemical composition of any part of the tree, from the tip of a root to the last leaf on it. He could tell you its tensile strength, everything about it. And there have been many books on the subject. Then one day, towards the end of his life, he decided to go out in the woods to see the tree that he had spent his lifetime studying, only to find out when he got there that he couldn't tell an elm tree from a hickory tree or from a cedar or from a sassafras tree. And as this story is told in the East, what it's telling is really very simple, that he had gotten so lost in the detail that he had forgotten to view the tree in its singleness, in its oneness, in its wholeness, in its entirety. Now, what I shall do here today, is, as best I can, is not talk to the intellect of you, because I can't compete with the intellect of you. I don't even profess to be able to. The intellect is the means by which we're able to weigh and measure things. The intellect is most important. We study to acquire the intellectual acumen that allows us to walk across the street without getting hit by a truck and make a living, to add to the sum total of the things of the world. So the intellect plays its part, and it would seem to me that in my own affairs, and that's all I can speak of with any degree of authority, the intellect played an overwhelming role in it, and I thought it was so all-fine and important until one day I discovered something else. I found the heart. And that is very simple, and very gentle, and very open and honest. And it's without guile, and it's without motive, and it's always present. And it hears what the intellect doesn't and could never hear. And it understands what the intellect could never understand in the twinkling of an eye, can't. And so today, as I go along as best I can, and as we settle down and get over this business of seeing personalities and so forth, I'll talk to the heart, not to the intellect at all. Now, for my own qualifications, I guess you'd like to know who is this one. I don't profess any special authority at all. I don't think, to start with, that I can teach you anything that you don't already know deep inside you. I think the truth, and every bit of the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, is included within yourself already. And it's there. It's just awaiting your discovery of it. My qualifications are just very simple. I determined at a very young age to know the truth. I was raised in sort of a hodgepodge of a family with Jewish heritage, and then later Christian heritage. And everywhere I went, I heard people say, this is the only way. My religion is right, yours is wrong. My philosophy is right, yours is wrong. This is real, and that's unreal. This is the truth, and that's error. And I decided I wanted to know where it was, if it was in religion at all. So I took up the quest. I guess you could say I have never stopped looking. I majored in religion when I went to college. I had the great fortune of going to India with a shop full of religions, and I studied the religions of the East. I finally had the grand fortune of meeting an old Dallas sage, and I lived with this man over a period of off and on for 4 years. A venerable teacher in the East. So I had an opportunity to study the East since I'm there. Then I came back and thought I would try to write a book about those things. But then, quite unexpectedly, one day I had an experience where I discovered the heart and knew that I had discovered the heart. And from that time on, my life has been quite different. I have understood things that I didn't understand before, and so. I have no other qualifications than that. After I discovered the heart, an amazing thing took place in my experience. I quit the search for truth. That is, from going from teacher to teacher as though the truth were out there someplace and from book to book. I stopped all that and I began a thorough search within myself to know myself and to understand myself. I quit worrying so much about what other people thought of what I did or didn't do. I quit worrying about what society or propriety said was right or wrong. I was concerned about what the heart within me said was the truth, because my actions, even as all of our actions, are predicated on our own determinations within, no matter who says what out there. We make the ultimate and final decision within ourselves before we act. And so from the point that I discovered this thing within myself, another thing happened. People began to see a change, apparently, in me, and began to ask me questions about it. They wanted to know how it was that I was not disturbed when others seemed to be. Or how I was able to win my way in arenas that others could not seem to find their way in. And so my experience has been one of people coming from far and wide to ask me these things. Now, I must tell you that this is a new experience right now for me. I want to know that. It's new. This is new. And so therefore, you're rendering a great service to me, too, here. I hope that I'll render some small one to you, but among the many fraternities and mystical societies and religions of the world, there is one point of common agreement. And that point of common agreement is that the only one to really find the truth or find peace within themselves is the one who looks for and wants to find. And by the same token, among the so-called masters of the world or the teachers of the world or the ministers, It's a well-known fact that only those who come to them are really willing to listen. You know yourself that if you had a lovely home and it was tucked away in the woods on a palatial estate, which was in itself in the midst of a very busy town, that you could set up a water fountain out on the sidewalk where everyone was walking up and down the sidewalk to give everyone water, and there a few would want it. But by the same token, you know full well that if somebody turned off the busy street and walked up the crooked walkway to your house and then knocked on the door and asked for a glass of water, that you'd give it to him and he would willingly accept it and benefit from it. And you know also that you would stop whatever you were doing to do it. And my experience has primarily been those coming to me. Yet I know that the truth about finding peace within oneself, the truth as the truth is, and not necessarily as it's proclaimed by the institutions, by society, by the churches, by conventions, that this truth must soon be revealed and disclosed so that it's made plain and simple and clear to everyone, to everyone. You will note that there's a new movement going on around the world now that many teachers who have been cloistered and hidden away are now beginning to move out and talk to the world at large. Even though it's well known that everyone isn't going to understand what they have to say, nor is everyone interested. Now I know this, that all of you here are interested in this, or you wouldn't be here. You are interested in self-discovery, you're interested in truth, or knowing yourself, or in finding a sense of inner peace, or you wouldn't be here. You would not be about the quest of looking if you weren't intent on finding. So I'll say something during the course of this thing, perhaps it will register in the bell. Now, it's important that I see this at the outset. Our society, or our intellectual system, when I say ours, I mean here in the United States, in the West primarily, is geared in a strange way, such that when one attends a lecture or a talk, the way one feels when it's over with seems to be the determination of whether it was a good lecture or a poor one. When we go to a church service, or when we have listened to a lecture by a professor. When it's all over with, if you feel inspired and uplifted and elated, you say, that was very good. And if you feel nothing or you feel a sense of negativeness about it, you say, that was lousy, no good. Now, it's very easy for someone who is eloquent to say things that will be uplifting, to say things that will leave you with a sense of inspiration, a sense of lightness. But this is not necessarily honest. I would call your attention to this fact, that if you were to attend a lecture and say it was on arithmetic of one sort or another, and this is the most simplified illustration, of course, but if the teacher made the statement that 2 + 2 = 5 somewhere during the course of the lecture, and then when the lecture was all over with and you felt nothing or a sense of negativeness about it all, you would be very prone to say, or we would all be prone to say, well, that was a pretty lousy lecture. He wasn't even accurate. He said 2 + 2 = 5. And the boom would immediately be lowered on the one who had done the talking. Of course, I know this is so because I've listened to lots of talks and I've heard lots of people say 2 + 2 = 5, and I would come away having lowered the boom on the speaker. But I would call your attention to the simple fact that when you heard the statement that 2 plus 2 is 5, you knew it was wrong. And what did his statement do? At that point, it sent you scurrying back to the principle of arithmetic that you knew deep within yourself that said 2 plus 2 is 4. And so this speaker who made a mistake up there rendered quite a service, though it was subtle and hidden, because he sent you scurrying back to the real within yourself. Now, when the talk was all over, what did you talk about? You talked about his mistake. And you talked about what he should have said. So I ask you now, did he really give you a negative lesson? Or did he give you a positive lesson? Instruction relative to the truth of identity or the truth of being that comes out of the East is very often done in this manner. And I do it. I would, therefore, all I've said now in this last little small bit of a diatribe is that the lessons that come forth from this discourse, such as it is, or such as it will be, are not to be determined by whether you feel elated or depressed when it's all over with. Because what I have to say, much of it will come out later. Much of it will be felt later. And the heart discloses itself slowly, slowly. I would like to say that there is an identity that we all have that we don't seem to be very much aware of. There is an identity that is infinitely more beautiful and more significant than we've been told about, or that we are schooled to believe we are. Most certainly the identity is not that image form you see when you look in the mirror. You know it has to be more than that. If for no other reason than because you can think, and because you reason and feel within yourself. So I would, while I'm here, like to call your attention to a greater identity that you are, and it's the means by which I did for myself arrive at a sense of peace, a sense of equanimity that I can't even talk about, or put into words, or describe, because it can't be understood. Really, intellectually. We have only intellectual words to use. Imagine, if you will, that you're actors or actresses and you're playing a stage role of Lady Macbeth or Macbeth. And because you're very good actors and because you pour yourself into this role with all of your heart and soul and with all of your might, and because you give 2 performances a day, day in and day out, for many days, many nights, that you begin to lose yourself in the part. And bear in mind, good actors and actresses do that very thing. They throw themselves so completely into their work at the moment that they are that part. Now, this is just an analogy or a picture I'm painting, but imagine yourself playing the part of Macbeth or Lady Macbeth, and you've thrown yourself so totally in the part that you begin to live the stage production as real. Suddenly, you are just that. You live in a castle, and your silver is monogrammed and so forth, and you hear of a Macduff who's trying to do you in. And suddenly, you are filled, if you're Lady Macbeth, with the grief of having killed a king, and you've blood on your hands, and you can't wash the blood off. Soon all of the events that are transpiring on the stage seem very real to you. And your anguish grows. And the reason your anguish grows is because, of course, you're living an identity that you are not. You have lost sight of a greater identity that is not set beset with the trials and tribulations going on the stage. Now, if at this time someone walks up to you and in your anguish, in your moment of real agony, and says, look, you've got a greater identity, a grander identity that you seem to have forgotten about and don't know about, your immediate reaction is generally one of repugnance or repulsion, and you say, what do you mean I am not Lady Macbeth? You can ask anyone you see here and they'll tell you I'm Lady Macbeth. Over there is the King of Scotland or something. Ask him and he'll tell you that my name is Lady Macbeth. Everything that we see with the eye and hear with the ear testifies to an identity that is just a body form. And yet we have heard time and again, from countless sources, that there is an identity that's greater and grander and at peace with itself, and wherein all the answers reside. If someone comes to you on in the stage production and tells you enough times that there is this grander identity, you and your agony is great enough you finally begin to listen. Now those who come to me who make long pilgrimages or they come from faraway places, I know have already had the anguish and the agony that is necessary to allow me to delineate the identity that is real as opposed to the one that is not real, and they're more disposed to listen. I tell all of you that right here, right now, there is an identity that is present, that is who and what you are, that is without trial or tribulation, that is pure and perfect, that has never committed any sin, and doesn't suffer, and knows all the answers, and is not distraught nor upset. And I can tell you that that identity is present right here, right now. And it's the fact of your being right here, right now. And you can, in the twinkling of an eye, even while you're here, even while this little talk is going on, discover it. Because there is no long road to finding it. There is no path to finding it. There are no spiritual nor religious nor social exercises necessary to be it, because you already are. And all that would preclude your understanding of it is a matter of excessive intellectuality that denies. We all know that right here, right now, this minute, there is an alphabet present. An alphabet. You all know it. You were taught it in the first grade. It's an alphabet. It's present. It's intangible. You can't weigh it and measure it, but you know it's here. And no one would deny the presence of an alphabet. Now, this alphabet is shown forth by the letters that you see. It's delineated by those letters. And you know that the alphabet is here, and you don't deny it, you don't argue about it, and yet you can't see it. Now, by the same token, all of you know that there's a principle of arithmetic present right here, right now. Totally present right here, right now. No part of it absent, no part of it missing. Not imperfectly present, but perfectly present. It's intangible. You can't weigh it, you can't measure it. You may not know all about it, intellectually, but you know that it's present. That if you have need to add up a column of figures or something else, you know that you can use the principles of it to solve the mathematical problem. Now, those of you who are musicians know that there is a principle of harmony that's present right here, right now. And it's here, totally here, completely here, already here. And there's nothing you have to do to make it here. It's intangibly here. And you may not know all about it intellectually, but nonetheless you know that the principle of music is here. Well, now, if we can say this about such things as the alphabet, about arithmetic, about music, what about the principle that is being this very life that's present right here, right now? Would we deny that there can be an intangible presence, being this very life that we call I or me or yourself? If we can grant that there is an alphabet present, being every printed word that we've ever seen, or that there is a mathematical principle present, whether you're up on the roof or down in the basement, or whether you're in a submarine, or whether you're on a cloud, or wherever you might be, that principle is present and you can go nowhere to escape it. What about the presence of a principle being this very consciousness of being? It is conscious right here, right now. Well, of course, there is such a presence, being, all we see, and all we feel, and all we hear. I would like to call your attention to something that can be most rewarding in your own affairs, and I think you can see in the twinkling of an eye. I know you can see it in the twinkling of an eye. But if you'll have to listen to these statements now with your heart, but if you'll listen, really just gently listen within yourself, not intensely, but gently. And to the best of your ability, leave the intellect out of it. Leave sagaciousness and all of that sort of thing out of it. Leave memory out of it. And just listen to this very gently with the heart that loved it. Right now, at this moment, the one thing that you can be absolutely certain of is that you are aware or conscious. As a matter of fact, this is where all the primary religions and philosophies of the world began. They began with the fact of consciousness, of awareness. You are aware right now of a room full of people. You are aware at the moment of someone talking to you. But where are you aware of the room full of people? And where are you aware of the voice that you hear? Where? Now stop and consider just a moment. Within awareness. Within consciousness. Now, within whose consciousness? Within whose awareness? You would say, well, within my own. I would have you stop to consider just a moment. Right now you see a room with people in it. And right now you see someone talking to you. But what you see is the awareness you are. Consider everything that you've ever seen. Say from the beaches of Florida, to the Pleiades, to the stars, when you look out at night. Where have you ever seen those things? But within one awareness. The one awareness you are. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever seen anything anywhere else? Have you ever been concerned with another awareness? In all honesty, have you ever been concerned with another one? You say, yes, I'm concerned with my old man's awareness. He's pretty sick. He doesn't understand what I'm about or what I want to do and so forth and so on. But where do you see the one called your old man? Where do you see one called a recalcitrant institution or a misled philosophy or something else? Where do you see it? Where have you ever seen it? Where have you ever been conscious of it? But in one place alone. One place alone. The awareness that is yourself. Consequently, you've never seen a sight but your own sight. Take the sounds that you're hearing right now. You hear those sounds. Now listen gently with your heart to this. These sounds you're hearing within yourself. Now, true, there are all kinds of scientific explanations. You can say, yes, there are wavelengths of sound. These sounds are vibrating the nerve ends within my listening apparatus, and this in turn registers within my brain and so forth and so on. But all of this reference to wavelengths, sound, vibrations, nerve ends, brain, consciousness, all has been recorded and is known in one place alone. Within whose awareness? Your own. The only one you've ever been concerned with. So every sight you've ever seen has been your own sight. And every sound that you've ever heard has been your own sound. Not somebody else. Just what you call somebody else. And what about the thoughts you think? You see, the sound on the outside and the thought on the inside, these are, one is external, one is internal, but they're both really the same. The body appears to be that point at which the external becomes internal, but when you look out at a sight, and if you recognize that it's within the awareness you are, you find yourself not necessarily looking out, but looking at yourself. And the thoughts, have they been anybody else's thoughts? Or have they been your own thoughts? Once upon a time I was in Korea and I was a soldier at that time, and I was in a very miserable situation. I was a company commander of infantry, and I was on a piece of critical terrain over there called Sandbag Castle. And this wasn't so many years ago. And I had a command post that was on the reverse slope of the hill. On the reverse slope means that there is a land mass in front of you and the enemy. And so whenever the so-called enemy would fire a gun, the bullets went over my bunker. But these gun positions had been there for a very long time. The line had stabilized for a long time. And the Chinese who opposed my troops at this point knew where the command post bunker was, and every few minutes they fired a burst of machine gun bullets directly over the command post bunker, right overhead. Now, any of you people who've ever had a bullet go over your head know that it just makes a crack like the sound of a whip. It breaks the sound barrier, and it's a crack. And in a combat situation where it appears that your life is at stake, it's not particularly a pleasant sound to hear. If you get very used to it. Well, every few minutes this gun was firing and the bullets went directly over the bunker. And there was a valley down behind us, empty, nobody in it. So the bullets just sailed away and went down into the valley and didn't do a thing. No damage was done, no harm was done. So just bullets directly over the bunker making a crack. And about, it would vary. Every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And the number of rounds from the machine gun burst would vary anywhere from 3 rounds to maybe 15 or 20. But it was just as regular as clockwork. And after a few days, it became real irritating, and I began to get disturbed about the whole situation. And being a soldier and doing what I was supposed to do, I put out word to knock out that particular machine gun. It was giving us a hard time. And we tried diligently to knock out a machine gun. We tried to kill somebody up there. But we couldn't do it. This gun was dug into the stone face of a mountain. I remember I even laid a 50 caliber gun up there in which I had put extra charges of powder and ammunition in order to get a real flat trajectory, and I tried to lay one right in the hole, and I couldn't do it. Finally, I called in, and let me tell you, this thing became, the irritation became worse and worse. Now, all of us suffer with irritations at one point or another. We're irritated by the way people move, the way they talk, their mannerisms, their gestures. Just think of all the ways we're irritated by society and by government and by what our parents do or don't do or what our kids do or don't do. How many ways we're irritated. Remember when you were just learning how to drive an automobile, how irritated you were every time you saw somebody do something wrong. When you knew what was right, you'd say, "Oh, he's violating the rule, that knucklehead," and so forth and so on. Think of how many times you've been irritated when you were driving an automobile. Just stop and think of the many irritations we have. Well, here, I'm telling you of a tangible irritation and what happened, and so that you can make an application of a principle, and you can do it before the day's over to see whether I'm telling you the truth or not. I became very irritable about this gun, and I got to where I was not effectively leading my troops. First we tried all kinds, first we tried to retaliate and could do no good, and then we tried the matter of escapism. We began to lay bets on, every time there was a burst, we added another buck to the pot on the table, and everybody would guess how many rounds would be in the next burst and the exact time that would take place. And anybody that hit got the pot. And of course, the pots would get pretty big before somebody would really hit. And so this was pretty good for a week or two. This was fun, you know. This had us, but the irritation continued to grow. I could even tell when they changed gunners on that gun, because I could tell each time they changed gunners, the man would have a new rhythm and a new system for irritating us and bugging us. The Oriental appears to be quite adept at irritating and bugging people. Just look what's happened over at the Paris Peace Conference. Look how they have absolutely irritated us to death in Vietnam, using all kinds of things that appear to be unique and different and unusual. So what we call the Oriental is adept at this matter of being able to irritate one. Well, the irritation grew so bad that I got, every morning I would try to write my wife a letter. And it finally got to the point where I couldn't even effectively write a letter. We would fight at night primarily because the Chinese would always attack at night. We would repel them, hopefully, or reestablish the positions. But then in the day, we'd try to sleep. Well, this particular morning, after a far fight that night, and no matter where I was, I could hear that one gun. I could tell that one, no matter where I was. I despised it with a passion. I called in an artillery liaison officer and I said, "I want you to lay in some artillery on top of that mountain and remove the top of the mountain." And we called in a battalion of artillery up there, and a battalion of artillery on a point is quite a sight to behold, on a point target. It was a tremendous noise and a tremendous explosion of dust and dirt and rock and mud and our whole book at the time. And when this artillery had settled down, I said to myself, "Well, you've got what was coming to you, you son of a gun. Good for you. You got it. You earned it. And now you've gotten it." And I felt great glee within myself for a minute. And about 30 seconds went by, and the dust settled, and that gun cut the scene directly away. Okay. I was totally defeated. I gave up completely and absolutely and surrendered within myself and felt totally hopeless. Those of you who have studied Zen know what hopelessness and what the sense of hopelessness, how it benefits them. At this time I had an experience, and I'd just like to tell you the experience, that all of a sudden it was as though I had something within me say, "Hey, Bill, what's bugging you so bad? What's bugging you?" And I said, "That noise." And the statement came back to me, "Well, what about the noise? Where do you hear it?" And I said, "Well, I hear it within my ears. Where do you think I hear it?" And this feeling within said, but within whose hearing is it?" And I said, "Well, within mine." And then it was as though the words came to me that said, "Well, now listen, is the difference between that sound and the sound of your son, who at that time was a child. What's the difference between that sound and the sound of your son? And the reply, of course, is obvious. I said, well, one sound is a good sound and one is a bad sound. And the statement came to me from within, well, who said that it's a bad sound? Who says it's a bad sound? Does the sound say it's a bad sound? And I had to suddenly come face to face with a very simple but beautiful sight of being. And that was that the determination of good and evil was purely a matter of my own doing. The sound had not twisted my arm and made me call it bad. The sound was just the sound being a sound. The sound had not said that it was bad. It was just the sound being a sound. And the bullets, of course, weren't hurting anybody. I had myself determined that it was bad for no reason other than maybe because society says that the babble sounds are bad, or war is bad, or that this is bad, or that long hair is bad, or that something else is bad. I had decided to accept such a determination for myself, and I then acted on it. And because I said it was bad, I tried to get rid of it. I tried to kill it, or I tried to heal it, or I tried to change it, only to my own absolute frustration, suddenly to come to see that it was just a sound being a sound. And that if I let it alone, I wouldn't be bothered by it. I would like to have you stop and consider now some of the things that you see that maybe irritate you at one time or another. A few years ago, the women used to wear floppy hats, and they're coming back into style again, these hats with a lot of flowers on them. I was in the midst of some Eastern studies at the time which spoke of doing away with ego, and so I used to see, every time I'd see a lady with a big floppy hat, I said to myself, there goes another ostentatious bit of ego trying to look beautiful and trying to call everybody's attention to itself. And I determined that it was a bad sight to see and was irritated by it. I remember pulling up to a stop sign and a lady with a floppy hat went by after the Korean War and after I'd had the Sunday experience. And I said, now what about that sight itself is good or bad? Who makes the determination? Does the sight make it, or does this one here as I make that determination? And it dawned on me that only I can make such a determination, even as right now only you can make a determination within yourself relative to good or evil. Right, now what have I said? I've said that every sight that you've ever seen is your own sight. And you can prove this in the twinkling of an eye by just being honest with yourself. You've never seen anything but your so-called own optical eye lens or your own thoughts. I've said that you've never heard a sound but your own sound. And you can prove this in the twinkling of an eye, because no matter what professor you've heard talking or who you said it was still your own sound you were listening to within the awareness you are. And I've said you've never had a feeling. It's your own feeling. Then I said that you have made your own determination from the word go, or accepted the determination of others from the word go, of good and evil, and have suffered therefrom, or perhaps benefited therefrom as a parent. Now, where does the dominion reside? Who within can make you say this is good or this is bad? Especially if you know you're looking at yourself, no matter who is talking to you. Where is the determination made? Who can make it for you but you yourself? Strangely enough, one of the points of agreement with all of the religions, the major religions, they speak of a beginning, and in one way or another speak of a center or a garden in which there is something at the center, or they speak of a sphere that does have a center. All the religions speak of a center. And the one that most of you are familiar with, there is the story of a tree that was in the midst of the garden, in the middle of the garden. It was the cause of all human trials and tribulations, as it was put forth in an allegory by Moses. And what was the tree with this forbidden fruit? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil was the forbidden fruit. We also know that within this same document, the same Bible, and within the same philosophy, very beautiful philosophy, it speaks of a final judgment, the last judgment, the day of judgment, meaning that following that, everything is better, or that the millennium has begun, or that perfection is then discerned and seen, recognized and understood. And here again is a point of common agreement with all of the religious philosophies of the world. We speak of a last judgment. For you men and women can, here now, within yourself, hang the apple back up on the tree, the one that has caused most of your anguish and agony, your own determination of what's good and what's bad, or, to put it like this, what you like and what you dislike, what you love and what you hate. You can hang that apple back up on the tree. And there's no wait about this. You can begin doing it right away, you know. The minute you see that all you've ever seen is your own sight, really, and all you've ever heard is your own sound, you can suddenly see that any condemnation, criticism, of an out there is only a condemnation and a criticism of yourself. That any lowering of the boom on an out there is really a lowering of the boom on yourself. And all of a sudden you can see what is meant by those words, to love all mankind is yourself. Some of you will see, in a moment of heartfelt honesty, that you are all you see, and you never see anything but self-revealing. Now let me just say a few words, if I may, about this thing called love. The young people in the world are very much concerned with it and have intuitively known from the very beginning that love is where it's at. The heart and the intellect appear to be at loggerheads. The intellect, being scientifically oriented, concerned with precision and mathematical preciseness, doesn't understand the heart because the heart isn't logical and isn't reasonable. You all know this is so, because in the name of love, you've done many silly things. You've seen a woman married to a man slob who was, that even God, it would appear, would have difficulty loving, and yet she loved him with a passion. You know that love. You've seen mothers with children that were handicapped in one way or another, as appearances go, and you've seen this monumental love include that child in every way. Yet reasonably, it would seem that the mother should be distraught and upset and disturbed and would like to do anything but take care of that child. Well, for what it's worth, and I don't know that I can say it right, I would like to tell you that love, as love is the way to go. But I would like to point out that love is your identity itself. You are love itself, and that love is not, as we've been taught to believe, necessarily just a way to act. And love is not what someone is supposed to do to us or for us, or that we are supposed to do to or for another. But rather, love is who and what we are. And the minute we recognize this fact and admit it, as so many young people are doing now, we suddenly recognize that there is no such thing as lost love, or hopeless love. There is no such thing as unrequited love or limited love. There is no such thing as aging love or immature love. There is just this identity that we are, which is love itself.